All right. Ready to go? Let's rock and roll. Okay, all right. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Bliss. We have the second panel for today. This will be the fashion advice panel, starting with the investigation of the socks that are now $435 on Cauldron. Yeah. So any fashion investors having a pretty good day? But in all seriousness, I have Callisti, Mathieu, and Dagger here for the technical panel. And I thought, you know, we could start by talking about a reaction to the panel yesterday. In my mind, I always think of the BCH ecosystem as, in some respects, like a company. And so the panel yesterday, I felt like, was kind of the product department. You know, the product department finds the problems, explains the problems, complains about the problems, and then the engineers have to solve them. So that's what we're here doing today. Now, some of the things they mentioned that seemed to be top of mind was volatility and stable coins, ease of use in wallets, and privacy were the three biggest complaints that I heard. So Callisti, starting with you, tell me about those three problems. What can or are we doing to fix those things on the technical side?
All right, so I guess we'll start with ease of use of the wallet, since that's kind of my domain. One thing that struck out to me right away was when Saqib had mentioned, even with Celine, the whole self-custody aspect is a little bit problematic because people will just simply lose their keys. There are some things we can do there. Last year, General Protocols brought some NFC cards, little tap cards that you could put up on your phone. And we can work on a wallet backup format that would allow you to store your keys on that card. And we can store a little bit of extra data than just your seed. Like if you have any kind of smart contract that's deployed on chain, we can locate those UTXOs if you save it onto such a card, because you can't do that off of just your seed phrase. I think that it's pretty important to just have a good backup scheme. It is a problem. I mean, if you lose your keys, you lose your money. If there's some kind of glitch with the wallet and if you didn't have your key backed up, I mean, you can lose money, and that's really important to have something to mitigate that. On the privacy front, while the upgrade today somewhat allows us to start experimenting with some of the privacy tech, it's not going to be until next year, if we end up getting loops and whatnot, that we'll be able to make such privacy contracts and transactions small enough that they'll be efficient. So that's something that I would look forward to there too. I do really hear the privacy concerns, and Cash Fusion is really, really good, especially as we get more users in the ecosystem. Anonymity online is mostly about how many people can be part of our overall anonymity set. So the bigger the number is just, it's almost like an exponential growth for as far as how to de-anonymize you if you could. If everybody is always reusing their addresses and everybody's always using Cash Fusion, I would say that's pretty much good enough. Now, I think if I was some kind of hardcore world-class criminal, maybe that wouldn't be good enough. Maybe I would still want to do something like a zero knowledge type thing, or what Monero does with its privacy. But I think for the everyday person in general, Cash Fusion is going to be good enough there too. And then what was the third?
Well, we'll take them one by one, I think. Okay. So Mathieu, I don't know if you have any thoughts on the usability, ease of use in wallets.
Oh yeah. So first, speaking to backups, I think there's a bit of a trade-off. So between making it easy and when a user creates a wallet, giving them like 10 steps they need to complete before they can actually start using the wallet. So, for example, encrypted cloud backups, I think, could be an interesting idea, because then even if your phone breaks or someone switches phone, I think that was the example, then if they remember, oh, I have a Google account, and they could plausibly still log into the Google, download the encrypted seed phrase, and then with an extra password that I hopefully remember, still access the seed phrase. So I think if you only have like paper backups, that's not going to scale to the masses. I think these are ideas we should definitely explore together with the NFC cards.
I think social recovery schemes might be good too. Where if you have trusted friends, you can split up your seed in a way that you need all parties to collaborate in order to reconstruct it, so nobody could just run off with your money. I think that's another good idea too.
And ease of use, I think we can also see it a bit broader. So quite a few people who I talk to have now been using the DeFi stuff and have been talking about the reliability or unreliability of Wallet Connect in certain cases. So I think we should just, yeah, I think that would already have an impact on the user experience if these kinds of, if you connect your wallet that this is stable and that you don't experience any issues with it disconnecting or when you change tab that you need to reconnect or something. So for me, that was some of the feedback I heard when talking to some of y'all here at the conference for usability.
Yeah, Dagger, any thoughts on that? Obviously, yeah, with the Wallet Connect in Cauldron integration, certainly that made things a lot easier, but we've maybe still got work to do there.
Yeah, I'm not a wallet developer, so I'm a decentralized application developer. And as a developer for that platform, it's you can make your decentralized app as beautiful and good-looking and user-friendly as you like, but in the end, you're relying on good wallets for good user experience. So as you were saying, like super reliable connection to the wallet, and also fast and just super user-friendly, that makes it better for all decentralized applications.
Does anybody know on the Cash Connect thing is going to be coming as the upgrade to Wallet Connect, but that was still only rolled out in BCH Guru, as far as I know, with the alpha version. Does anybody have any insider thoughts on that, or would that help to address the problem a little?
I'm honestly not sure. From the technical like specs of Cash Connect and the difference between Wallet Connect, I'm honestly not sure. I haven't gotten that far yet.
Yeah.
So I think it's currently in pre-alpha, so it's kind of don't implement this everywhere yet. With Cash and Ice, I got to experiment with it as the first wallet. So I think, yeah, it's actively being developed, maybe as being tangential to the XO stack, because it's mainly Jim, so the same people working on that stack. So the big advantage of Cash Connect would be that it's fully HD. So with Wallet Connect, it's a big drawback that HD wallets like Celine, you have multiple addresses, but then Wallet Connect only sees and knows about your zero index address. And so that's confusing because you have a bunch of assets, maybe you want to use them in a dApp, but then, yeah, for users, it just adds mental overhead. Where it would be with Cash Connect IDs, you can give explicit permission to certain addresses or certain UTXOs. You can much more granularly opt in to certain permissions, similar to maybe how if you download an app in the App Store, you clearly see what it can and cannot access. And so that already works in Cash Connect today, but the multi-address things, I think, are very much still in development.
Okay. I didn't know that. Is there anything else that you can speak to on the Cash Connect? Like even HD support would already be massive, but is there any other parts of the spec that the specific advantages that has?
Yeah. So the big advantage is with Wallet Connect, the dApp builds the transaction. So kind of you get the transaction in your wallet and you maybe still see, oh, I spent this much BCH and I get a token in return or something. So you have some idea what is going on. But the transaction building all happens on the dApp and the wallet is kind of just a signer. Whereas with Cash Connect, the idea is that there is a template that is constructed by the dApp and then handed off to the wallet. But the wallet is smart enough to select its own UTXO, so it doesn't have to reveal everything to the wallet. And then also because it's a template, for example, if you have NEH or Cauldron, you have specific parameters that are plugged in to spend from a contract, then it could parse this from the transaction and display it in a human-readable and understandable way. So it'd be much safer to have these templates because then it's clear what's going on for users, whereas now this is not always the case.
Yeah, so then that would mean like we're talking about this recoverability of funds issue is then potentially we have solutions coming on two fronts in terms of the UI integration and the backup schemes and then also at the infrastructure layer, because that would enable things like we were talking at the bar the other night about receiving payments that are self-custodial, but maybe if you don't recycle the addresses automatically every 14 days or you don't open your phone in that amount of time, then it opens a backup recovery path and things like that to stop people losing money. Okay, so that's ease of use. How about privacy? Calista, you already talked about that. So Matthew, do you have any thoughts on the privacy front?
Yeah, so Calista said it's not all possible yet today on the main chain, even with the upgrade. That's definitely true. But much of the tooling, like Libauth, has all it integrated already. So if you use the next version, you can already try experimenting with zero knowledge proofs on the Bitcoin Cash stack and try to do advanced cryptography in smart contracts. So yeah, I would really like to see some people experimenting with this and then maybe find potential issues or things that can be improved, or just learning as a community, or like the developers and researchers, so that we all collectively have a better understanding. Because up to now, there wasn't a real use case for any of this stuff. So I feel we can all learn more about the inner workings and the possible use cases. That's what I would like to see already. Some of this development starting to take place even before it's maybe activated on chipnet or mainnet. And then secondly, I think we don't only need privacy on the blockchain layer, we also need privacy on the network layer. So Jason Dresner has been writing some thoughts on this more recently. For example, Dandelion and some of these other privacy schemes, where if you now send a transaction, it could be easy for people who monitor the network to find out where you are located, not just maybe which country, but also really where you are, what your IP is. And even if you have good HD wallets and you don't leak any privacy on the blockchain layer, if it's clear who you are on the IP or network layer, then I think that's still a big privacy leak. So we need to take a holistic approach at privacy and consider like all the layers.
Yeah, so Dagger, you're sort of paving the way in demonstrating with the Moria V1 that you can code everything up and have it ready to go like live on the day of the upgrade, right? So given that we are maybe still one more upgrade away from having strong privacy tools, what do you think are the prospects that we can have some stuff already kind of ready to go that 1 year from now, as the upgrade goes live, suddenly everyone discovers they've got the world's most amazing privacy wallet to catch up to the competition?
I don't really, that's too far in the future for me. So, yeah. But I would like to comment on privacy with regards to DeFi. I see that we are having, now that we are entering like the DeFi space, we are still like copying stuff from Ethereum. For example, Wallet Connect just connects to one address. We're treating it like an account. And having support for HD wallet would be a big improvement there, but still, we don't have cash fusion for tokens. We don't have we haven't developed any privacy scheme for anonymizing tokens. That's one challenge we have to face. Just by entering DeFi space, we also have to take into consideration that we also need to have privacy for our users and figure out how to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, at least in some respects, the industry has got a bit of a respite from the pushback from governments, right? We've been seeing a little less prosecution of developers, and that was something that we talked about last year with the Tornado Cash situation. But being who you guys are, do you feel like the threat level has decreased a little bit in that respect, or are you still got that on your radar that it's potentially risky to be publicly in this industry building this kind of stuff?
Oh, it's definitely kind of risky, yeah, especially in the EU. There's a lot of regulatory stuff coming up, and you never know if the governments are going to retroactively punish you. You just have to hope they're not. It would definitely be better to be anonymous. And if I had the option to choose again, I would be anonymous.
Yes. Okay, Matthew, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think even for the stable coins, I think Dagger would agree. You already have like a lot of worries about compliance, but that category seems fine for now. But privacy, it seems to be the, especially in the EU, recently there was an announcement that by, I think in 2027, they want to have all privacy coins banned in the EU. I don't know. Yeah, the motivation, I guess, is to combat money laundering or whatever. I think that's a real threat. Of course, if you mainly do research and discussion and prototypes, then then that's fine. But if you under your real name announce like a Tornado Cash equivalent, especially if you are in the EU, then you need to be very careful. And I would talk to many people before recklessly doing something like that. You need to consider your own personal security, of course.
Yeah, I mean, we're somewhat just at the whims of the broader world. I mean, we can push forward as fast as possible. But Callisto, you were talking yesterday about having multiple Anon accounts and stuff like that. Do you think that's something maybe we need to see more of in the BCH community? Obviously, ideally, you grow the talent pool, but at the same time, since it takes time to build up trust and reputation in the community, maybe we should all be spinning up, you know, second accounts and putting in some proof of work. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, just because you're doxxed doesn't mean that you're trustworthy. Not necessarily. I think it would be great to have more Anons in the community. In fact, there's probably plenty of people in other crypto arenas that could come to us, re-roll their account, especially like BTC or Ethereum people. And I mean, as far as government crackdown and whatnot, in some degree, I don't feel the fear as much in the U.S. And on the other hand, the current U.S. administration is very unpredictable. So we never know if just tomorrow they just decide, yeah, we're just going to ban crypto, even though Trump was in the BTC Nashville conference last year and, you know, praising everything about Bitcoin, right? But politicians are always just saying what we want to hear, right? I don't have a fear for myself personally. I don't think, you know, a three-letter agency is going to come after me or anything, but you never really know, right? Working in this industry can be dangerous. So I think being Anon is good, but on the other hand, I think the more proof of work you develop, and especially if you're in a position that like myself or you are in, at some point that transparency becomes a little more necessary for the trust, especially like if you're asking people for like a bunch of money, or if you're doing something like we are directly managing, well, not managing, but we're writing an app that manages people's money. And so like, you never know if I was like some rogue agent and you couldn't just look up my business, you know, you don't necessarily know who I am. You don't necessarily know if I'm going to push some malicious code or something. But since you can very easily dox me and be like, oh, okay, well, you could probably come and find me and wrench attack me if I did something to you. So who knows, right? Or yeah, there's lawsuits, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that's just it's kind of a double-edged sword in a certain way, because the more people that are able to be out and vocal, it does help to normalize it, which also builds political will against, you know, prosecuting developers and so forth. So there's kind of pros and cons on both sides. Okay, tell me about volatility. Obviously, we've got the two stablecoin masters on the stage right here, but that's something that has just plagued crypto essentially since the beginning. I don't think anybody has ever tried to onboard somebody without them complaining about what if it's volatile and the price goes down, etc., etc. Now, luckily, there's been a lot of innovation in that in the DeFi space, and having caught up, we're now able to become a part of that, and then it will need to be integrated into wallets. So we're not going to see it all immediately, but there's promising steps. Dago, maybe starting with you.
Well, I'm used to the volatility, so it doesn't really affect me. I know that in the long run, things tend to go up. And also, volatility is good if you have a decentralized exchange, because that's how you make APY. But yeah, I can see that for normal users, that absolutely volatility is hindering crypto. And when we lost Moria, we immediately saw like niche shops starting to accept it. So there's definitely high demand. We will have more merchants eventually on Bitcoin Cash when we have stable assets.
Yes, Matthew, you've joined the race here with the stable coins, which I am personally thrilled about, because having the two competing implementations means that you'll be forced to come to some universal standards, which can be built into wallets and so forth, which means if other people then want to enter the same industry, it's not already, you know, monopolized by one player. Why did this particularly attract your interest to jump in on?
Yeah, so I think stability is a very big problem in crypto. So personally, I think because crypto is so cyclical, it kind of makes sense if you feel like we're near the end of the bull market, or that you want to like maybe lock in some of your profits, or like at least not be fully exposed if it can go at any time minus 50 or up to minus 80%. And yeah, you could use a centralized exchange for it, but I think it's very nice that there exists stable coins, so you don't have to trade all the time at a centralized exchange. So many people in crypto do this to lock in profits, for example, of their token trades or of the crypto assets they hold. And I think many people also realize that this volatility is a problem. That's why you see many different solutions. You already have on Bitcoin Cash any hedge, then this was tokenized as a stable hedge. On SLP, before we saw an attempt as a more custodial and trusted stablecoin. Many people use just the stablecoins on Ethereum, whether it's USDC or something more decentralized. So I think that there are already many options. So in a sense, we are not. It would be too narrow, I think, to see the two projects competing only with each other. We're competing more broadly with any solution available to users. So I think, I think we of course want to offer the best possible stability solution. And currently, some people have been really enjoying AnyHedge, for example. But there's also been some issues with this for users, that it's limited in time, or you need to refresh, or the premiums are kind of unpredictable. Whereas I think with if you just have a cash token that's a stable coin, then you hold it in your wallet until you yourself move it, and there's no expiration or no premium. But there will be many different volatility solutions, and I think that's healthy. And then users can see what they like and use it or not use it, and then
Calista, you and I were recently actually talking to some users who were really feeling this pain point, and it was the first thing that was kind of requested. Now, developing a wallet, we're in the sort of fortunate position that if we just build the tooling, the stable coins and such are already there for us. How do you see the volatility situation playing out in terms of wallet dev?
Yeah, so I think that we need some really one-click solutions in your wallet. A lot of people have kind of pitched this idea of maybe you can put a freeze button in the wallet. I believe Paytaka actually just did this. They have their new stable hedge thing that was just mentioned. I just think that the more accessible that we can make that, the better. Volatility is obviously a problem. I mean, I'm kind of like Dagger. I'm used to it at this point. But I also think from the user and consumer perspective, I really like BCH Bull's hedging feature at AnyHedge. Because it's time bound. So I can just do 30, 60, 90 since I'm earning in BCH, but I still have to pay my rent in dollars. I could just hedge 3 months ahead of time and not necessarily have to worry about trading in and out of a stablecoin. So I think from the consumer level, I really like hedging, but I think if I were a business, I would be more interested in stablecoins because they are not time bound. I can just go in and out, they're more liquid. So I think as long as we can make both of those things really easy and accessible, that's going to be a big help for people who do need these volatility tools.
Okay, so moving on to today, we obviously have the VM limits upgrade going live. I've actually been quite interested that this year, it feels like there hasn't been a ton of chat just in the conversation about it, because it's so obvious and everybody's so on board with it, which is a payoff for having done good work to build consensus, but regardless, it is still a big step forward and will open new avenues. I'm wondering if each of you could just give me your thoughts on this upgrade, and if you think it'll immediately create new room for developers and maybe excitement in the industry. Dagger.
The limit thing about the upgrade is basically just setting free the functionality we already have. We have been very limited in how complex contracts can be, but the possibility of making big, beautiful, complex contracts has always been there. We just had stupid limits. So I'm very happy about that part of the upgrades. As for bigger integer size, that's going to make a lot of stuff more easy. And I can't tell about the CK stuff, but apparently that also helped with that.
Maybe one could say that it is Bitcoin unlimited.
Okay, Matthew, any thoughts on the upgrade today?
Yeah, I'll start with the big ends. I think it just removes headache for developers. Because, for example, with Calderon, we were discussing at some point an overflow behavior where if you have a lot of tokens and a lot of BCH in a micro pool, and then you do some math on these parameters, and you can only go up to 64-bit integers, then then your financial contracts, you have to worry about. It's like you have to consider, oh, can it overflow? Will the transaction just fail? And that just removes this headache and like worry. So I think even in Coldron, there might be like a few things which... Like
we have a lot of workarounds. So it's very good to have them go away.
Yeah. And so the same for VM limits. So it was kind of a headache for contract developers. You run into this limit, you need to either remove code or restructure. So just headaches all around, whereas now no longer the case. And I think they went, especially Jason Dresner, put in like incredible engineering efforts, because clearly we couldn't easily lift the opcode limit, which was the thing that had been proposed multiple times. Like, why don't we just raise it? But as Kalin very well explained in his talk, there are multiple like attack vectors, or like the worst case would get exponentially more bad, whereas normal contract developers would only get slightly more power. And with this, the worst case stays the same. So if you want to exploit the system, there is no extra leverage you get from this upgrade. Whereas as normal contract developers, we can get to do much, much more, which is the way I like to see it.
Calisti?
For me, I'm excited about the VM limits because it does add so much more power to the VM for people who are developing smart contracts. I'm not much of a smart contract developer at this time, but I think if I was, I would probably run into those limits. It sounds like the other contract developers' 201 opcodes is just a little bit limiting, and I can imagine how that would be the case. And then especially like with BigIn, you can have like a massive amount of tokens minted whenever you make like fungible tokens. So if you're trying to do math on that, I would anticipate overflow issues. So I think it's just a good move that we are doing this. I had another thought, but here, classic Calisti, I have two thoughts and forget the second one, so we'll move on.
All right, we can always come back to that. So yeah, we're looking good for this year, and then Callum was just talking about the upcoming chips that are proposed, Loops, PetaScript, and OpEval. So let's just quickly rip through those. Loops, Calisti, how are you feeling?
I think it kind of makes sense to have it in 2026. It looks like it's... pretty non-contentious, honestly. I think a lot of us are in agreement that it's a good thing to do, with the Bitcoin script language being based on Forth, which is a very established language. We already have these constructs in this language. We can look at that as prior art. And I feel like it makes sense. Initially, I was skeptical because, you know, with loops and people have like this, I guess, FUD about Turing completeness and whatnot. But because we have sane limits, the problem with Turing completeness, I guess we'll try to make this non-technical. There's a problem called the halting problem where you don't know if a program is going to stop executing at any given time. So since we do have sane VM limits, we can say that we definitively know when a transaction is going to stop executing. We don't run into that problem, so loops aren't a problem at that point. There's no infinite looping that can crash the nodes.
Yeah, Matthew?
Yeah, what I like about looping is that it mainly challenges dogma, like the comment we Kalin talked about earlier. Bitcoin has no loops. Yeah, well, why not? Like, if you have sane VM limits, then you can just have loops, and pretty much any programming language has loops, and loops are like an important primitive for many things. So yeah, loops, I think, also a no-brainer. And of the three, that also seems like the most likely to definitely reach consensus by November or something, and that we can lock it in. And then we have pay-to-script.
Hang on. Tag it, loops.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. As I am no developer and consensus developer, I tend to look at like the worst case of stuff. So there is a negative side about loop, I think, and that is... you cannot really do like static analysis of the worst case runtime costs. And you could, I can imagine just in worst case, you had a contract running for years, but the loop size keeps increasing for some reason. Maybe there are like more participants or whatever. And at some point it's just going to hit the limit randomly and just halt. And what happens to that contract then? Is it our fund stuck? That's like a downside. Otherwise, I love it.
Okay, all right, okay. So are you expecting to do maybe, is there anything we can do to mitigate that or do more analysis, or it's just a cost we're going to have to bear?
I mean, static analysis tool, that's not my profession, so I would have to ask someone else, yeah.
Okay, all right, something to look into. Okay, next one, PetaScript, Calisti.
I'm excited for PetaScript because given that our smart contract capabilities are so much more powerful, I anticipate a lot more people will be deploying contracts that we can publicly interact with. And what Pay2Script script allows us to do is effectively see an API for a contract. So what we have now is Pay2Script script hash, and a hash, we can't tell what's behind that contract. You just have to try to spend it and guess, or maybe there's some external documentation that can say how to interact with this contract. Whereas with Pay2Script script, we can just scan the entire chain, and if it's a Pay2Script script, we can just look at it and know exactly what that contract does byte for byte. So I'm very excited for that. I think it's a pretty good idea.
That's you.
The Pay2Script idea, it also relates to what came up earlier with relay versus consensus. So if you are a miner, or you know a miner, or you have some service where, which you can access a miner, then you can already do this kind of stuff. Then you can already have like a locking script which is like custom up to 220 bytes. But for normal developers like we cannot access it because you need to have this direct connection to a miner or service. So I think, yeah, this is also a step to equalize or these relay limits and consensus. So for me, it makes a ton of sense. And I think also for these escrows, ZCEs, yeah, it's important that you can actually do this in a standard way, that you are not, yeah, that nodes will not broadcast it because it's a non-standard transaction. So I think, yeah, this equalizes the playing field for everyone. And it's already possible in a non-standard environment.
All right, so pretty positive. Dagger?
The Cauldron contract is less than 200 bytes, so Pay2Script is going to make it even faster and cheaper to use it, so go for it. Yeah.
All right, okay, that one's getting a lot of support.
I would like to add one thing. We mainly talked about the big thing that's in the name, the Pay2Script, but I think, as Kalin also mentioned in his presentation, it also increases some other limits which might be very relevant for contract developers. With the VM limits, we keep the worst case the same, but retarget some of the limits. And the Pay2Script chip, it actually suggests we remove one of the other standardness limits, which is on the input script size. It's like 1,650 bytes. So that would now be the actually binding standardness limit for contract developers. And it would this chip suggests to just remove this to also get away from standardness and consensus differences. And then you can do up to 10,000 bytes with standard transactions, whereas now, after the VM limits upgrade, this 1,650 bytes will be the binding limit. So that will be, like, if developers start writing very long contracts, that will be the limit they now run into. So I think saying we know what the worst case is, but we feel comfortable increasing it, I think that's a good step, because at this point, we have the same limits, so we know even if we make the worst case worse, it's not like before where it's exponentially worse, it's just a slightly worse, where you give the normal contract developers also a lot more power. So I think, yeah, the VM limits enable all kind of future chips.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things Callan mentioned as well too, and we don't need to go way down this rabbit hole, but just the BTC guys and their inscriptions, arbitrary data on chain has been very topical, and he was making the point that if we bring that standardness more in line with consensus, then it's possible we will get people putting scripts with their JPEG data and so forth in the chain. Now, the BCH approach is more just like a blockchain is just data. As long as you're paying for it, that's fine, and we'll handle it, you know, with the UTXO good set management or UTXO commitments or something. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Calisti. Are we running a risk that we end up in some kind of community battle over how much arbitrary data is okay? Is it a P2P cache system, etc.?
Yes, I do think that's a risk. Just frankly, Matthew and I were actually kind of talking about this over lunch yesterday. Actually, and with Jet too. So we were just kind of thinking of some absurd cases, like can we put an NFT on an op return output? Turns out the answer is yes, because of how the data structure of UTXOs are. It would be useless to do, but we can do it. And so technically that gives you an extra, 40 bytes of data that you can just put into a transaction on top of the op returns 220. If there's a difference between standard relay transactions and what we could just send to a miner that's still consensus valid, I do think that those should be consistent, because we can see that this is a big issue on BTC, especially with miner centralization is a big issue. So you've got the Mara slipstream on BTC, where you can just they accept these non-standard transactions, and they can reap massive amount of fees based on this. Actually, I think I just saw, I don't know, maybe it was Mechanic or somebody posted a difference between Mara's fee intake was like 36% higher than everyone else's. And then if you look at Ocean Pool, the one that's running Bitcoin Knots and has the filters, they are minus 36%. Isn't that interesting? So I do think that that's kind of a risk that we should be aware of when we are messing with these limits. And if we do have any major differences in standardness rules, I think that those should be kind of tightened up. Yeah. But I did want to also add on the VM limits, when we're analyzing worst case scenarios, we do now have a very robust benchmarking suite, so we can kind of get ahead of the curve on those things and see it coming ahead of time.
Matthew, inscriptions on BCH, it's the future or no?
So I would say it could be a controversial topic, just because if you look at Bitcoin history, in 2014 there was Counterparty, and that uses the op return already. And back then, I think Bitcoin Core actually lowered the op return to make it non-viable. And then also Vitalik talked about this, that he wanted to first build on Bitcoin using op return and like a meta protocol, I think. But then it was clear that it was not just pushback, but they actually tried to block him in every way possible. So that's like the historic baggage. And then also with Bitcoin Cash, we increased this op return to allow for SLP and also to allow for memo.cash. So we have seen, just by increasing the op return, we enable some new use cases. But if we just enable the maximum transaction size to be data, then some developers will find it, or some applications will find it useful to post the full token metadata on chain, including the image. Because then you can get to store it kind of for free on all the nodes in the network. So that is a consideration that we would have to be very careful about. And it is contentious because it has come up multiple times in Bitcoin history, including with BSV. It was another big topic where they enabled better data on the blockchain. And at some point, most of their transaction data was just forecasts about a rainy day today or not. So I think that's also a bit silly. But it is a nuanced debate, and reasonable people could fall on either side. So I think one thing is that you don't need to go from 220 bytes to no limit at all. We could do steps and see, reevaluate. Also, the filters, they do work to some extent. So you have Mara Slipstream on BTC, but on BCH, I don't think we have any kind of service. So if you wanted to put your current token metadata fully on chain, that would be non-standard. So you would have to team up with a miner So this is a real hurdle. So that's why we don't see it. But if you remove this hurdle and it becomes 10 times easier, then people will definitely do it.
Yeah, Dagger, what do you think? Is on-chain data the future?
I think it's the future for Bitcoin.
They're locked in, eh? It's over.
I mean,
goose is cooked.
They have they still have a block size that fits on a floppy. So if they're gonna have security, someone has to pay a lot of fee for this small tiny thing. And I think they can survive by securing their blockchain by art. Yeah, people will pay a lot money for
world's
art.
Best art gallery, yeah.
But on more serious note, I'm not a fan of putting data on blockchain. But if people are going to do it, I would try to avoid adding changes that allow them to do it into the UTXO set, because the UTXO set is like the biggest bottleneck we have. So avoid adding possibility, and if there is a possibility to add it to UTXO set, try to incentivize having them somewhere else, like in op return or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right.
Can I just add something? Yeah. If we're gonna have data on chain, it should be an op return, because we can prune that off of the nodes. So UTXO set growth is gonna be the biggest bottleneck, and that's also where our major scalability issues and bottlenecks would be. UTXO set access is one thing that we need to consider. And then also, if we pruned the entire blockchain, the UTXO set is what you have to keep. I had an idea where it's like, okay, well, what if we made it so op return data costs 2 sats per byte instead of 1 sat per byte, because that way we're disincentivizing this arbitrary data on chain while still allowing it. I think if we had some kind of...
Then people want to work around it, though. That's the problem. Then yeah, that's what we're talking about. Then if they can pay to script at 1 sat a byte, they'll do that instead. Yeah. It's kind of the same problem just reinvented.
It's just a lot of nuance with it. I'm not really sure what the correct answer is, but it is a concern for me.
Yeah. I also think we just need to look at how it plays out in reality, right? If we see that there is a Maya Slipstream kind of service for BCH, which already makes it accessible to motivated devs, but then perverts minor incentives maybe, or create some inequality in or like unintended side effects, then you have to be more proactive in responding to this. Or also there was a protocol, Bitcoin Computer, who also stored data on chain in some in the UTXO set. So if we see the UTXO set being abused because they cannot fit enough data, then I think we have to be proactive and raise the limits to just avoid this scarce UTXO sets, which is kind of costly to keep, to avoid kind of pollution.
Yeah, okay, next one then. Final one is Op Eval. Matthew, I know you actually were chatting about this in the Telegram the other day, so let's start with you. What do you think on the Op Eval?
Yeah, I really like Op Eval in the context of CashCrypt, because we have seen people defining kind of macros, reusable code that they can use in their CashCrypt contracts. So with Op Eval, this would be like natively supported by Bitcoin Cash. Then you could have some data which can be evaluated as logic. So it turns data into logic. So if you have some data, a function, and you can copy it on the stack and then execute it, then you can reuse it in multiple places and it's very byte efficient. So for example, zero knowledge proofs, they would reuse a ton of transactions. So that's why there the compression could be over 100 to 1,000 times of compression. Whereas if you have to reuse the code the whole time, it would be pretty much non-viable economically, because your transactions are huge simply because of this duplication. There have been some interesting discussions about what's possible edge cases or like evaluating data as logic in an untrusted setting. Like if the user can provide any data and then you execute this as logic, is this unsafe? So there has been discussion about the security, especially in executing untrusted or possibly untrusted data as logic. So yeah.
There's also the static analysis thing as well. I know Emergence, similar to what we just mentioned before, is really concerned about that and making sure that's hashed through. What do you make of that aspect to it?
Are you
concerned about we add op eval, now you can't statically analyze your contracts?
Yeah, so I'm not very concerned about it, but I have been following the research post, so I do think this is an important thing to get really fleshed out, so everyone agrees what we are giving up or potentially giving up. And I think this needs to be in the risk section of the chip, because you cannot only pitch the benefits and the upside. We need to be very thorough in documenting all the negatives or possible risks that this introduces.
Dagger, what do you think, op eval?
That's a good question. I'm kind of undecided. I see the benefits, but it's also a big change. So
more research needed, more time to think.
More time needed, yeah.
Luckily, we got plenty of time to play with Callisti.
Yeah, so I mean, there's definitely no urgency or rush there, in my opinion, to get eval in. My entire time as a programmer, it's kind of been drilled into my head, like, eval is dangerous, eval, you got to be really careful with it. And I think that would still apply here. I do see a lot of benefit to the idea of having some way to have reusable functions. That's a very clear benefit to me, but I think it's something that we do want to be really careful in analyzing every angle of that to make sure that we don't shoot ourselves in the foot. And then to the static analysis discussion that had come up, I'm not going to lie, it's not something that I've really fully wrapped my head around, but just my gut feeling is, well, I like immutability, I like the ability to have static analysis, so that's probably something that is worth keeping that we should consider.
All right. Okay. So that's the short-term future. Then we've got the sort of more far-term future. I have actually a few things here, but I'm actually kind of interested to see if I just throw it to you guys, what you'll pick or what you're thinking about on the more long-term kind of development roadmap, maybe starting with you, Callisti. You're nodding. Have you got something you'd like to see get chipped for 2027, 2028?
I'm really interested in millisats, like fractional Satoshis. I think that's overall going to be necessary once we are at some kind of global adoption scale, like say 100 sats per dollar, like sat cent parity. What is that, like $10 million or something like that per BCH? So very far-fetched to think about going from 400 to 10 million, right? But if we hit global adoption, it's going to happen, right? So it's something I would like to get ahead of while we have the ability to be quick and nimble with our research. I think it's something that makes sense, but it's not necessarily pressing and urgent right now.
Matthew, far future wish list?
Yeah, I have some things on the far future wish list, but they are not a consensus layer per se. So we could see changes to the node, for example, Xtinner. So this is more on the block propagation. Or we could see, we talked about the database in BCHN, LevelDB, and how it could potentially be changed for something more efficient. So not all improvements, of course, have to be on the consensus layer. There's also a lot of software improvements that can be made on the node level. I'm not sure I have something very specific.
I'll prompt you. That's all right. If there's nothing that comes burning to mind, then that's...
Especially because we have been focusing on the VM and script, and I feel like there we have like all the very advanced ideas, which seem very futuristic, even, for example, OpEval. But I think there's likely other parts of the consensus layer that could deserve some more attention. For example, if you want to introduce fractional Satoshis, then you likely need a new transaction format. But if you're breaking the transaction format, then we want kind of to implement our whole wish list all at once.
Yes.
And so this could potentially include like read-only UTXOs, which has been also discussed quite a bit at the conference. But also, all other things, which there's inefficiencies in how the transactions are put together. Or like maybe you could have reuse signatures, so the detached signatures, and then you could reuse them across inputs, things like this. So a lot of interesting ideas, but also, of course, if you batch a lot of different unrelated things, then it makes it that much harder to be sure that you have all the ones that you actually want and to get consensus on each part. So, but at the new transaction version would definitely be something that we need already to start talking about, researching, and then when it's ready or when we feel confident in it, then we can discuss how we would deploy it.
Yes, and Jason Dreisner has his TXV5 proposal as well, so that is in the works. Dagger, what do you make of the future?
I have a wish list,
yeah.
Of course. One thing I would like to see is perhaps some protocol improvements on miner extracted value. Now that Bitcoin Cash is entering DeFi space, there are going to come like new opportunities for miners to be malicious. And one proposal that is, I like his shorter block time by Bitcoin Cash Autist, so shout out to him. Something controversial would be maybe we could start talking about the pre-consensus again. I think that's maybe an interesting topic again, now that we have DeFi.
Okay. All right. Matthew, any thoughts on either of those, the shorter blocks or the pre-consensus?
Yeah, I would definitely like to start discussing shorter block times and the trade-offs. I think pretty much every blockchain that has been launched after Bitcoin lowered the block time, even from some of the change we don't necessarily like the liquid sidechain by Blockstream, 1 minute block time, or some of these newer roll-up sidechains that they want to develop on Bitcoin. For example, I was talking to a Citria developer at ETAM, and he told, we'll have a 2 second block time. So I think that's maybe ridiculously to the low end, but just to demonstrate that the trend really is faster is better. I think Solana has like 400 milliseconds. So that's not to say that we should copy that, but it's just that the trend to stick to 10 minutes, it's good to reevaluate this and that we pick something sensible and let's research what the trade-offs are. And I think now that 10 minutes is like a historic artifact. And Jason Dreisner pointed out that it was actually lowered. Satoshi lowered
it
from 15
to 10 or something. We're already on fast blocks.
Yeah,
you know?
I thought that was funny. And it does have important implications for DeFi. Because if you have these transaction chains which get very long, like if you have popular protocols, it's not always economic or like to build on the last transaction. Sometimes you would just ignore half the unconfirmed chain and start branching. But this is not nice because then users don't know what will be confirmed. And with a 10-minute average block time, it could take up to 40 minutes that you know, did my Cauldron trade, did it get accepted or not? I think currently that's not a big issue. But once we see more regular users, but also more bots who don't mind branching these transaction chains for the best price, then I think it will be quite bad to have an average 10 minutes. So.
I mean, the guys with the biggest incentive to do this branching is, of course, the miners. So, Yeah, that's the, but the good thing about it is that if there is like a minor extracted value attempts, you cannot change like the transaction order. You cannot change how, in what order events happened. So either your transaction goes through or not, but there's still the ability to just slice the whole mempool chain and do something malicious on the top.
Callisti, on these ones, pre-consensus or one-minute blocks?
I am a little skeptical about pre-consensus, but that, I think that's mostly because I don't fully understand it. So I know that there are some community members who are really interested in, say, like Avalanche pre-consensus, which has been implemented on one of our sibling chains, Zcash. So clearly the research has been done somewhere. There's clearly some value to be had there, and it's probably worth looking into, but I'm skeptical. As far as faster blocks, though, I am really impressed by the research that Bitcoin Cash Autist did. Like the chip, even as it stands right now, seems pretty convincing to me. Obviously, we do need to keep doing more research on that. But I think that I'm currently swayed in favor of decreasing the block time.
Okay, all right. I've got two more. So last technical one, I guess, is quantum resistance. That's also something that is kind of on the impending horizon. We don't know when the hammer's going to drop on that necessarily. Certainly in the BTC community, they're starting to look into it. There's a question of what do you do with the coins that are unsecured against quantum by default? Some of them already have the script hashes, they're less vulnerable. Could we, you know, burn the old coins, or is that violating property rights? How soon do we need to be ready for this quantum stuff? There's a lot of different elements. Callisti, maybe starting with you, what's your thoughts?
So as far as I'm aware, SHA-256 is quantum resistant, so we don't really have to change like the hashing algorithm or anything. As it's what ECDSA, I think, is where the risk is. So the way that we sign our transactions. So for instance, Satoshi's coins, well, maybe we could crack that with quantum computers in the future. I think it's one of those things where technology can move really fast. So while I don't think there's going to be any kind of quantum risk, say, like overnight or maybe even in the next 2 years, it could be in the next 2 to 4 years, could be in the next decade. We really don't know. That state of the art really can move quickly. I mean, it's like AI just came out of nowhere, right? So it's something I think we should be aware of, but again, is not like a pressing right now. And then at least we do know that SHA-256 is safe, which underpins like most of what we're already doing. So like the hashes that you were just saying for like a pay-to-script hash, wouldn't really be concerned about that, or like a P2P cage. I think it's the encryption stuff that we got to be aware of.
Okay, Matthew.
So also I'm not a quantum expert. My impression is that it may be a consideration for the next decade, but that it's hard to predict, of course, with how the rate of innovation will go. I'm not sure I have any specific. Of course, you can discuss how we deal with the Satoshi coins. I think if we know for sure that some coins are for Satoshi, then it would be unreasonable to have those exploited. Then, of course, there's also some discussion about later Satoshi coins, whether they did or did not belong. So then the property rights issue could come up. You also mentioned the hourglass ID, where this... Yeah. This would be a very big change to the social contract, where we say we need more kind of inflation, actually. But then we don't want to break the 21 million limit because it's a meme, but we can kind of reintroduce these old coins. But I think it's a very sensitive topic, and we would have to have like a existential crisis kind of reason that we would need to do this to introduce the tail emission. And as we said during the proof of work debate section, many people agree that they would rather not compromise on any ideals, even if it means that the success is not guaranteed. So those are just some thoughts about the quantum stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually kind of funny if you go and look in the BTC guys, this is one issue that we are fortunately on the same team as them. So anything they cook up, we can almost always either just copy or improve upon. And they're, well, not freaking out is probably putting it a bit too strongly, but in their case, Satoshi's coins getting unlocked and creating a huge market dump is like a much bigger threat to their whole sense of what are we even doing here, whereas we're still going to have a P2P cash system, and having a smaller market cap in some ways protects us as that, because if there is an event like that, you know, it will be easier for the market to absorb. So it's just a very interesting dynamic dagger on quantum.
I think the first thing is to add the option to use the quantum resistant stuff, add new signatures. I know our Nexa has done it, they added its new signature stuff that is quantum resistance. Those things are a lot bigger, you know, the signatures are quite a lot bigger. So it's going to cost more, so it's an opt-in thing, but that's your choice then.
Okay, all right, final question as we're just about to hit lunch. I was wondering if you guys could just give me some thoughts on how you found the conference, and maybe what kind of side conversations you've been having, or what you feel like the vibe is among the technical community, and the discussions that we've been having. This agenda has been what I've thought is important, but maybe you've heard otherwise. Matthew, maybe starting with you.
Some of the discussions at the conference?
Yeah, just like what's the vibe? Like, this is just what, you know, what is on my mind, the questions that I've asked, but it's possible, you know, I'm not a part of everything, so...
Oh yeah, so overall, people are feeling very positive, because I think we have been making a lot of progress. Like, Cash Tokens was only introduced 2 years ago, but now there's many projects doing stuff with it. I think the discussions are wide ranging, from proof of work to quantum to the operator and relay stuff. So it's super fun to talk. And for me personally, there have been some questions about the stablecoin design and borrowing and how that would work or how that could play out. I love to discuss those topics, of course. And I think we're headed in a very good direction. So overall, very positive, and I feel the same energy here all around the conference.
Dagger?
Well, I love to meet the people I meet online. Okay. You guys are usually much more nice in person.
You can look down on them in person. You're taller than everyone.
Yeah, and also I love to see the demo stuff. There's always something mind-blowing. I've seen many things today at this conference. I love it.
Amazing. Khaleesi?
The vibes have been great. Like, the conference is great. I think it's even better than last year. And last year was great, too. So, kudos to you and everyone else who's organizing, of course. The side conversations have been nice. There's a lot of theory craft, definitely, over lunch and beer. So it is nice that we can kind of summarize these things here on the technical panel, and we're going to go back on Bitcoin Cash research and decide, all right, what direction do we want to move in? But I do really feel like our community is extremely aligned. I don't think there's been any kind of contentious discussion. I think everybody kind of agrees where our issues are, what direction we need to be going. I really just feel like our whole community is on the same page right now, and I think it really shows in this room.
Amazing. Okay, well, that will wrap it up for our technical panel. Put your hands together for Khaleesi, Matthew, and Dagger. Looks like we've got one question. Let me just check the time, because Jonathan's going to... Okay, all right. Noel, do you want to have one very quick question? Can you just shout it out for me? Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah, we gotta head off to lunch. But that is a good point, that the merchants can...
Stream can't hear what he's saying. Can we repeat?
Yes. So Noel's just making the point that in the Townsville, where they have the merchant adoption, that merchants are perhaps more tolerant of volatility than we might expect, because if you can give them an underwriting guarantee, that will help them solve any doubts or concerns that they have. And that is true, but I think we're also seeing concern about volatility on the user side. You know, merchants is great, and you can handle them more individually, but to get user adoption, and certainly that's what I've experienced, the end users are and can be quite panicked about that, especially in places where they don't have a particularly a lot of disposable income. It can be very, very critical for them. But nevertheless, there's of course solutions and things to be worked on.
I have one very quick comment on that.
Okay.
If you're a merchant and you're accepting both your fiat currency and your BCH currency, it's not that you're going 100% BCH. You still have a little bit of wiggle room there. It's not that all of your clientele is going to be in BCH. So the volatility is a bit of a limited risk there as well.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, that will do it. And we will go to lunch. We've run slightly over, so I'll give you a little extra time for lunch. And we'll be back in here at about 1:45. That's it. Enjoy.